This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jeronimo Cortina, an associate professor at political science at the University of Houston and associate director at the Center for Mexican American Studies.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Well, we normally come to you from our favorite hangout, but unfortunately this week, because of lockdown in Harris County and across most states, we are coming to you from alternate locations. I am happily ensconced in my closet. Jeronimo, where are you?
Well, I'm just sitting down in my home office.
That's good. That's good. Well, we all have to adapt. Obviously, the world is different than it was a couple of weeks ago when we were on hiatus. It's a new world in effect, right?
It is. It is. It has completely changed. I mean, just imagine what was the world a couple of days ago, 30 days ago. You know, I was still going to the office and everything was, you know, kind of normal.
Yeah, and now Tom Brady is a Buccaneer, right? Britney Spears is talking about wealth redistribution. So there are a lot of things that are changed. One thing that's not changed, though, is that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, at 87 years old, is still working out. She's doing it more than I am. So obviously, the more things change, I guess, the more they stay the same. So good for her, right?
Right. And I told you, man, you have to start working out. There's a couple of apps, the 7-minute exercise app that in theory has been, you know, proven, I guess, quote unquote, scientifically, that if you do the 7 minutes, you're done.
Okay, good. Well, I've got all the time on my hands that you could possibly have. So time is not an issue. Time is an issue, though, in the election, right? So we're going to talk about what the sort of national implications are to these changes. And we're going to talk about some of the state level changes as a result of the coronavirus. But let's first talk about some changes to 2020 that aren't necessarily related to the coronavirus, starting with the fact that now it's a two-person race. Representative Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii has dropped out of the race.
Oh, really?
Surprise!
Right. Well, yeah, of course. I mean, she had, I think, like 2 or 3 delegates. She was not doing very well in fundraising. And it was just, not an uphill battle. It was completely impossible that she could stay in the race. And now it's, as you say, 2-person race. And we don't know if Bernie Sanders is going to stay in the race for long or not, given that over the past primary elections in several states, he lost really, really, really bad.
Yeah. And the other sort of dynamic here is that she has endorsed Joe Biden for the nomination, which is basically keeping with the way that most of the field has rallied around him. Do you think that this changes the dynamic? Obviously, Joe Biden has got a fairly direct path. It's a little harder for Sanders. We'll talk about that in a minute. But is Biden's promise to appoint a female vice president going to change the dynamic here? Could that, in fact, be Tulsi Gabbard? Is it going to be another rival, maybe Kamala Harris, or somebody who might be a little bit out of the box, like Oregon Governor Kate Brown, who is obviously on the radar for many people because Oregon has been a central outbreak site for so many people who've gotten the coronavirus?
I mean, first of all, Vice President Biden was very clear, right? When he said it, he said, I'm going to name a female for vice president. On the other hand, Bernie Sanders says that in all likelihood, he would do the same. So he was, you know, thrown behind a little bit in that opportunity, right? In that political opportunity. But I think, I mean, there's a couple of names. You have, as you say, Kamala Harris is the one that has been sounding a little bit more. But then they have to be strategic, right? Kamala Harris, African-American. Biden has a lot of support with African-Americans. Kamala Harris, in terms of support among women, is not that very strong. So the question that the Biden campaign is asking is, okay, who among these very, very good field of female candidates is going to bring us a little bit extra in terms of, you know, electoral gains that could open doors in parts of the electorate where he had not a lot of traction?
And that's really the kind of million-dollar question for the Biden campaign is, does it matter? The scholarship in political science actually is mixed on this, but most of the studies show that a vice presidential nominee has very little effect on people's voting behavior and only gives the candidate a slight bump in the state where the individual vice president is from. So choosing California-based Kamala Harris doesn't necessarily help you anyway, but right. Perhaps choosing Amy Klobuchar, who's more moderate and from Minnesota, it's not a swing state, but a Midwestern state, potentially has that effect. Also, we'll talk about this in a minute too, but Gretchen Whitmer, who is the governor of Michigan, definitely is on the field list too, because right. she's been a high-profile kind of foil of Trump, and the fact that it's Michigan shows that there's a kind of industrial edge that I think the Biden campaign would like to play up from the vice president's background.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, it's not early, but given the current context in which we are, who's going to be that candidate that gives the edge? I understand what you say in terms of what political science literature suggests in this case, but now it's completely different times, right? Right. And everything has changed in the past months. And also since 2016, since President Trump won the election, everything has changed dramatically in the way that we conduct politics, in the way that the country is polarized. So we'll see who's that going to be that lucky person to be nominated as a VP.
Yeah, and one sort of dynamic to this was something we saw happening in primaries that happened during the coronavirus outbreak and when it was first starting, and that was that Illinois Representative Dan Lipinski, who's one of the few blue dog Democrats remaining that oppose abortion rights, lost his bid for a ninth term to a challenger. The challenger, Marie Newman, was a progressive-style candidate in the mold of Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This shows to some degree that the Democratic Party is moving in a much more progressive direction.
Right.
I should think that this whole virus outbreak and the recovery from it is going to once again sort of harden that element of the party. And there's going to be a lot more calls for that. So Joe Biden is going to have to kind of play along with that and probably move in that direction.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we saw it, a part of it, and we're going to talk in just a second, the stimulus bill, right? Now we have seen provisions that have not been in place since the Great Depression. So those things move, right? You can see some sort of a cycle that those ideas are being recycled once again. And now you're going to need a president for the next term that has to engage some sort of way as the Great Depression was engaged by the federal government.
Yeah. Well, let's talk Texas. Speaking of endorsements, we had an interesting outcome to what was happening in Congressional District 17. This was a district that Pete Sessions, the former member of Congress, was running in. He's been accused of being a carpetbagger. This is a race to replace Bill Flores, who's retiring. Even Bill Flores said maybe he shouldn't be the nominee, but he's in the minority here because four of Pete Sessions' rivals have endorsed him in that race. Sessions grabbed 32% of the vote in the primary. He's going to be up against Renee Swan, who got 19% in the runoff. And so this is some hardening of support for Pete Sessions.
Right. And it's interesting because all these people, what they're saying is just that Pete Sessions is the candidate that can unite the district, that represents truly conservative values, whatever those are, because also Renee Swan talks herself as a true conservative, small business owner, so on and so forth. So we'll see which ones of these two candidates represents the best opportunity for the district to move forward in these terms, right? But it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen in this situation.
Yeah, and like we said, so much has changed. So obviously the big news of the week and the big news of the month and probably the year will be the spread of the coronavirus. Let's first talk about the process of voting. We can talk about the players in a moment, but more than a dozen jurisdictions have changed their primary dates. You've got several states that have moved to an all-mail ballot. There are 11 primaries that are planning to take place on June 2nd, mm-hmm. which some people are calling Super June's Day. Right. So it's really changed the dynamics of the race. Logistics are obviously a big part of this, right? How do campaigns function in this world? And what are the prospects for the different parties, right? So I could easily see registration declining. In fact, some reports out of Ohio say that there's already a decline in registration. The federal government has kicked in about $400 million in the stimulus bill to help states with voting, but this is a drop in the bucket compared to what most states spend on elections. And if they want to make some big changes, they're still going to have to pony up some extra money. And that's hard for states.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you look at how this virus has hit the states' economies, right, it's shown that its impact goes beyond, you know, simple numbers. If you, for example, compare the numbers that we have had here in Texas yesterday, unemployment claims were around almost 300,000, right? That's half of the national unemployment claims that happened in the previous big economic crisis in 2007-2008. So we're now in huge and very unknown territory. So when you're talking about elections, right, and comparing with state budgets, states are going to be concerned in terms of what I'm going to do with 300,000 people that are unemployed, and do I want to put money into that, or I want to put money on elections, right? It's a very complicated trade-off.
Yeah, and one that states are not going to take, right? They're not going to spend money on elections if they don't have to. And in Texas especially, these are local concerns. And so the state's going to punt that to local governments who aren't going to have the resources to be able to spend. So that's a complication when you've got two-thirds of people say that they're not comfortable going to a polling place. So mail ballots are really a sort of strong potential change to this. But even those aren't perfect. You've got problems in rejection rates, so that we know from the scholarship that younger people and racial and ethnic minorities are experience a higher rejection rate for mail ballots. There's also a disparity in return rates. So people who are less affluent are less likely to return a mail ballot. And we know in Texas that there are all kinds of prosecutions and laws against trying to vote harvest, and that's very broadly defined. So it could be complicated to be able to generate the kind of change needed if the state wants to do that.
Well, absolutely. But the state, on the other hand, has to come up with a solution, right? If you cannot go to the voting booth or vote center or whatever it is, right, you have to come up with a solution. That solution, I mean, I don't see another thing that is going to be other than mail ballots. And a lot of different organizations are pushing for that, right? Especially on the progressive side are pushing for that because they think that is going to benefit turnout on their side. And some conservatives are saying, you know, well, no, I don't think so. I don't think it's good. So we'll have to see what happens. But once again, it's going to be the problem of implementing that in a couple of months. It's going to be the problem of what happens with those ballots that are, you know, the signature perhaps doesn't match the ID, yes, or they didn't submit this piece of paper, or they didn't submit that. And that's going to take, for example, you know, maybe 3 or 4 months after the election to know who actually won once those mail-in ballots have been validated.
Yeah, exactly. And even if you could run an in-person election, you have to have people who will do it. And there are states and counties and cities that are having trouble finding people to work at polls. So it's going to be a difficult time to administer elections, and the states are going to have to figure out some creative way to do this. We know, though, for a fact that history shows that during these kinds of outbreaks that we see turnout decrease. A record 100 and almost 40 million Americans voted in the 2016 election. That's going to drop, no doubt, the way we saw it happen in France, for instance, and the way that it's happened in other countries. So this is going to be a serious concern that will affect primaries and has affected primaries, but is also going to affect what happens in November. But the people matter too, right? So what are some takeaways that you've seen the last couple of weeks in terms of how President Trump has handled the coronavirus outbreak, and what impact does it have on prospects for 2020?
Well, I mean, we have seen, right? We have seen a complete change in his tone early January. Well, first of all, you know, the federal government knew about this thing in December 31st, 2019, right? They knew that the coronavirus was coming. They knew that it was just a matter of time when it was going to come, given, you know, how supply chains are designed, how global travel is designed, and the whole inter-global connectivity of all the people in the world. So they knew that. At the beginning of this year, obviously, President Trump said, well, you know, it's just a flu. In a couple of days, people are going to feel very well, and that's it. And, you know, miraculously, right, One of these days, this thing is going to disappear.
Yeah, he literally said that, right? Like, right. Just, I mean, by miracle, it's going to go away.
Right, like, boom, it's going to poof, just like that, right? And, well, we are I lost track of time.
Yeah, right. It's not August yet.
Right. No, well, it feels like August, right? April 2nd, and now everything has changed. Now we know that this is very serious, that the numbers of people that could die in the country are huge if we do things 100% right? And that's a big if. So his tone has changed, and just a couple of days, his tone was very somber, right? This thing is real. And that, I think, has to have some implications in terms of how it's going to be judged in November at the electoral ballot.
Yeah, and we've definitely seen organizations like Priorities USA spending millions of dollars to hammer him in swing states like Minnesota and Michigan, Florida, Pennsylvania, because they want to essentially put the nail in his coffin. The goal is that they're going to try to suggest that Trump is not handling the situation well. These ads, if you've seen them, are really rough and make it look like the president of the administration has just fallen on the job. I think, though, that there's going to be at least some measured partisanship that's going to hold him afloat, right? He can't necessarily fall too far because Republicans still believe he's doing a good job. And those splits mirror every other split we see in like the entire country on every policy issue. But I want to talk about the economy because obviously that's going to be one of the most significant factors in how people vote. The scholarship shows that if you see a percent decline in wages of 3% or more, there's a 1% or more drop in the vote share for the incumbent party. Now, I don't think that you're going to see that same linear relationship just because partisanship is going to hold what the economy looks like afloat. But I do think that there are going to be some Republicans and even some, you know, leaning kind of moderate conservatives who, generally speaking, vote with Republicans but might vote for a Democrat in certain circumstances, look at this and say, you know, this is not the president's fault. Now, maybe some of the actions they took were, but the economy, which is going to be the lasting impact of all of this beyond just the unfortunate death toll we're likely to see, is going to be the major factor in the election.
Well, I mean, yes and no, right? When you look at that literature, I mean, the context surrounding those elections were completely different. I think we are in a space that we have never been. So it's an outlier in the data, right? So on the one hand, the way that I see it is, you hear the president and perhaps some Republicans in Washington, right, saying, well, it's not the president's fault. He has been taking this very serious on and so forth. But then on the other hand, you have a counter message that is happening at the state level, even with Republican governors and county judges or mayors, and saying, this is the fault of the federal government, right? Even Republican governors saying the federal government is not responding. The federal government is not giving us test kits. The federal government is not giving us PPE equipment. So that, right, in the minds of the voter, is going to say, well, the president is saying X, right? But my governor and my mayor are saying Y. And people are paying, I think, more attention nowadays to what's going on in their local world rather than what's happening at the federal level.
Yeah, I'm sorry I took this to make that happen, but I think it's important because, like, we know so much of the politics and policy that's generated in this country is done at the state level. So that's a big factor. In fact, let's shift and talk about that. Obviously, the Texas Senate race is on hold like every other kind of campaign, but there are some things that are transpiring, in part because John Cornyn, who is this incumbent senator and the Republican from Texas, is still legislating, trying to work out these sorts of stimulus packages. He, though, did make some fairly inflammatory comments about China in the opening days of the outbreak, saying that this was China's fault and that they are transmitting these diseases because of their culture. Mm-hmm. The Democratic Party and the two candidates who are running in the runoff for the Democratic nomination, Senator Royce West and MJ Hager, have basically said this is scapegoating and these are kind of racist dog whistles. Is this going to be a problem for John Cornyn, or is this the kind of thing that he assumes is going to play to the Republican base? And if you can make it a base versus base election, the Republicans win.
Well, I mean, I think it might play for his base, but once again, if he plays for his base, he's not going to play for the other side of the base, right? I mean, for the other side of the coin. So, you know, Democrats are going to say, well, this is just a political use of this disaster, right, that we all have been experiencing. And no one here, right? I mean, and this is the very interesting thing, is that no one is safe, right? So to a certain extent, everyone is going to be on the same context. So if they start talking about it's because of the Chinese, et cetera, then, right, that's going to play to a certain extent. But then, you know, Democrats can counterattack. Well, you knew since December 31st of last year. What did you do? Nothing.
Yeah.
And then the other hand is that you see a very smart political move of the Chinese government is sending stuff to the U.S., right?
Yeah.
Last PPEs. And, you know, here you go. Here you go. Here you go.
Yeah. Well, it's playing out in other races, too. So one that caught my eye was in the Congressional District 23. This is the district that Pete Olson is retiring from. Kathleen Wall is the self-funded runoff, in the Republican runoff candidate. She has got an ad that just basically lambasts China for its sort of place in this whole outbreak. Chip Roy, who's running in a competitive race for re-election in Congressional District 21 against Wendy Davis, is been on record voting against the stimulus package, along with several other representatives from Texas. I think that those kinds of comments, the kind of approaches that they're taking, can backfire potentially. You're going to have a new political world at the end of this where people are willing to allow for the federal government to help. And maybe not everybody likes it, but at least temporarily, like the New Deal, there's people who all are on the same page. Now, you're going to see some splits on that for sure down the road. But as it is now, I think that Republicans run the risk of essentially being on the wrong side of this. And some of those kinds of comments, some of those votes might come back to hurt them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you see it, you know, the way that this stimulus package played, right? Democrats fighting for, you need to help the people. Forget about corporations, forget about, you know, the too big to fail kind of approach that has been used both by Republicans and Democrats. So you're seeing a different focus. And now you're seeing that the federal government, right, when people are saying, well, should we decrease or diminish or shrink the federal government? People are saying, well, nope, yeah. Maybe nope.
Maybe not. Yeah, exactly. And you're going to see at least temporarily a kind of consensus that the federal government can help. This is also going to actually change the way that the kind of local leaders are thought of. And so like you said earlier, this makes people focus on local government. And in the long run, that's going to help the Democratic Party because there are a lot of candidates that are potentially future stars for the party. And what they need to do is to get some of their, you know, kind of bench team onto their all-star team. So mayors like Eric Johnson, you've got county officials like Lita Hidalgo in Harris County, even Joaquin Castro has been very critical of Greg Abbott. So you've got this kind of emerging cast of players who, for the Democrats at least, are going to be the next generation.
Right. And, you know, and a couple of counties are, you know, in terms of Texas, are following a very interesting pattern. Like, for example, Fort Bend County Judge, right? Got a poll out and asking citizens of the county, hey, what do you want me to do in terms of the next steps? Do you think that the approaches that the county have been following are good or not? Are you doing this? Are you good? So the feedback and the showing of the people of the county judges that they're trying to connect and gather information, I think it's a very interesting move. And as you say, these new players, right, are, you know, saying we cannot do more tests because we don't have kids.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that highlights the role that governors play in this. But the president has been very critical of some governors, especially like the Michigan governor, like we talked about earlier. You don't want, I think, to pick a fight with the swing state governor in a time like this. You don't want to pick any fights in a time like this. But if you are seen to be kind of isolating or alienating certain constituencies or playing favorites, it really looks bad. And I think those are the kind of things that are going to hurt the incumbent party if they continue to play that game.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And what are going to be, you know, when we're looking at these, the effects, for example, on the Texas budget, what do you think is going to happen tied to the stimulus package? But then we were running a surplus, oil production is going down, the economy is going to be in a standstill. So what's going to happen to that budget?
It's going to be a cratering of the revenue that the state is able to take in. The state takes in almost 60% of its revenue from sales taxes. It takes a smaller portion from severance taxes, from oil and gas taxes, but it's not just that money that flows into the state's coffers. It's also about the downturn in the oil patch that's going to create unemployment and it's going to hurt businesses all across the state. So it's a ripple effect, and that's going to create what could be between a $20 and $30 billion hole in the state budget. We haven't seen that big of a hole in the last 30 years. So this is going to be a tremendous sort of problem for the state. I mean, it's so big a problem that they can't even pay the bills for the current budget, let alone thinking about what the next budget will look like.
And rainy fund? Do you think that now we're going to tap it, or, you know, it's like, no.
It's raining.
Right.
I think it's almost a statistical certainty, to quote one state senator, that they will tap it. It's at about $9 billion. It's losing revenue because some of the way that the money flows into it is based upon severance taxes, and that's obviously not as strong as it was. So those numbers are going to be, I think, a little bit flat. But there is no chance they're going to get out of this without tapping that. But at the same time, most of the legislators want to keep a minimum number in that. So they want to keep $4 to $5 billion in there. So, you know, they can play around with $4 or $5 billion and still have enough left over. But it's definitely going to be used.
I mean, and just imagine what happened the last time that we had those cuts. K-12 education was cut down by around $4 to $5 billion.
Yeah.
And this session, we just approved, or they just approved, I was not there approving anything, but the legislature approved, a huge, huge budget for K-12 education. And next session was going to be the session of higher education, right? So we're going to see a huge impact on the state budget.
Yeah, the last time we had a big downturn like this in the 2011 session, the legislature cut about 41% from higher ed. So higher ed's going to take it on the chin. But I think you make a good point about public ed. The price tag for the reform efforts that were put in place last session were $15 to $17 billion. Mm-hmm. They took credit uniformly, bipartisan wise, for that. They cannot walk much of that back, but they're going to have to because the money's simply not there. So once again, they wrote a check that is going to be hard for the state to cash.
Right, right, right. It's just going to be very interesting from a public policy perspective to see how the Texas government really reels in and try to save as much as possible in terms of this budget. I mean, we're going to see huge cuts and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, the bad news is we've been here before, but the good news is we've been here before. The state's governed itself in these crises before, and they will get through it. We will all get through it. And it's going to be a pinch. It's going to be tough for a lot of people, but the state will rebound, as will the country.
I agree. Well, another interesting situation currently going on in the state is this whole issue about criminal justice and what to do with, jail inmates that have or have not contracted COVID-19.
So the governor has essentially said that certain people cannot be released. And this is contradictory to orders, at least in Harris County, which are under federal orders to allow for people who are eligible for kind of a personal recognizance bail to be released. The governor has been sued on this issue specifically, but the broader concern is that the governor said that he can suspend these laws, and it's not clear that he can. In fact, people have pushed back on this effort. The litigation on this issue suggests that the only people who can suspend laws are the legislature. It was written in such a way as to stop the judiciary from trying to suspend these laws, but it certainly would apply to the governor in some situations. But we are in unprecedented times.
Right. And it's a very interesting state versus local control versus this versus that we have been played out for the past 2 or 3 years as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And so Governor Abbott took some criticism because it took him a couple of weeks to be able to submit what we think now is a statewide shelter in place order.
Right.
But obviously, they don't want to say that because it sounds a little bit too aggressive, and that's troublesome to some of the Republican base. But it's in keeping with what most big states have done.
Right. Absolutely. All right. Well, I guess, Brandon, this is it for this week. Certainly next week, we're going to have plenty more. And Party Politics is being recorded here at my home office.
And in my closet between the sweaters and suits.
There you go.
Hey, big thanks to our producer, Troy Schultz. Special kudos to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd the Bunker Holslander.
I'm Jeronimo Cortina.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.